My name is Jeff Lerner, and I interview elite performers from a wide range of disciplines, entrepreneurs, athletes, celebrities, scientists, artists, and more. This is Unlock Your Potential.
Welcome to another episode of Unlock Your Potential. This is Jeff Lerner, your host. Always so excited to be back with you, having amazing conversations with amazing human beings. So far, we've only had human beings on the show. I might have to update that intro at some point. Anyway, today we are joined by Dan Ariely, who is a professor of psychology and behavioral economics at Duke University, a founding member of the Center for Advanced Hindsight. I cannot wait to hear more about that. Even just from the name alone, I'm intrigued. Dan is a behavioral economist. He researches behavioral economics, and probably more importantly to most of us than the fact that he does that research, he attempts to translate it into layman's terms and describe it in plain language. It's honestly really, really fascinating stuff. He has a book called Misbelief. He's a really smart guy that does TED Talks and comes on podcasts and teaches at a prestigious university, and we're lucky to have him. And I could spend a lot more time on his bio, but honestly, Dan, I'm more excited to just talk to you if you're okay with that.
I'm also not very excited about my reading my bio.
Yeah. Okay, perfect. So behavioral economics, I feel like, is a place to start. As a heads up, I am gonna try to delve more into the man himself. If you're open to it, I might end up asking you questions about your childhood and your life, and how I'm always interested in how a person becomes the person that does the interesting thing, not just the interesting thing. But in this case, I do want to start with the interesting thing. So behavioral economics, my first exposure to it, I guess formally, was the book Freakonomics. Mm-hmm. Which, was my first introduction, I guess, in an explicit sense to like the irrationality of human behavior and the tension within economics that tries to quantify human behavior on the basis that it's scientific and rational, when in fact it largely isn't, and hence the melding of psychology and economics. So let's start there. Can you just maybe share as a context for everyone, like your work? What is the basic work that you do and kind of the message that you exist in the world to share?
Yeah, so the basic difference between standard economics and behavioral economics is that, as you said, in standard economics, people assume that people are perfect. We take all options into consideration. We think about the long term. We compute everything. And we always make the right decision. In behavioral economics, people say, not so fast. Let's just, instead of assuming those things, let's just put people in different conditions. Let's see how they behave. And we all know how people behave, right? People don't sleep enough, and we don't take our medication, and we don't exercise, and we overeat, and we text and drive, and we argue about whether the toilet seat is up or down, and you name it. And this realization that the standard economic model, the rational one, is interesting and so on, but we're very different than that. And my first book was called Predictably Irrational to make the point that we're not random. It's not that we make mistakes as random, but we make systematic deviations. For example, we're all tempted to text and drive while it's very dangerous. We all tempted to check our phone late at night and stay awake too much. So now, with this realization that people are predictably irrational, there's also the question of what do we do about it? And we don't want just to give up and say, okay, people make mistakes. We also want to think about how do we design the world for people who are irrational. So for example, if you say, how would you design, food for people who are irrational? You wouldn't design buffets, for example.
Right.
How would we design phones for people who are tempted too much? So we don't stop at just describing it. We also kind of say, how do we fix it? And by the way, that's also a really good link for entrepreneurship, because you basically say, where are opportunities to fix the world? As a behavioral economist, you walk around the world, you say, let me look at mistakes. Let me look at mistakes that people do in their romantic life. Let me look at mistakes that people do when we teach kids. let me look at mistakes everywhere. In fact, in everything you look, usually I start by saying, let's assume that people don't know what they're doing in this domain. You know, even though, you know, I'm 56, I've been sleeping for many years, right? I have lots of hours of sleep. You could say, I should be a sleep expert. Like, what if I'm an amateur? The truth is I'm an amateur. But you know, I say, what if people don't know how to spend their money to maximize their happiness? And what if people don't know how to sleep? And then you say, and if we understand human nature, we can also think about how do we fix it? How do we make things better? So that's basically the agenda.
So after I read Freakonomics, I remember I was on vacation. I want to say I was in Laguna Beach. I have the picture in my mind. I'm pretty sure it was Laguna Beach, California. And I remember I went out on the patio of the you know, Airbnb or whatever, wherever we were staying. It was some beach house. And I remember having a really profound feeling of like, I think behavioral economics might be the most important thing in the world to study. Because it's exactly like if I always remember George Bush, the first one, when he ran for president, I think it was him going, you know, it's the economy, stupid. It's the economy. Like, that is what everybody's basically keying off of, for better or for worse, in terms of overall quality of life, if we want to be reductive and make it about one thing. And then behavioral economics is how human beings interact with their own set of economic possibilities. If we crack that, I mean, I guess we still have to solve for like love and health and, you know, some other things. But I mean, we've got a long way towards human fulfillment if we solve behavioral economic questions. So
Let me just say that on the two grounds that we talked about, is the first is that we are truly fascinating. Think about something like placebos. The fact that you can take a pill with nothing in it, people would tell you it's a painkiller, you would believe them, and it would actually act to reduce your pain. That's just amazing. It's true, that's how it works. But we are fascinating. You know, the way that the human mind works is just fascinating. So that's the first part, is that we're really fascinating. Like, people think that, oh, the fascinating things are the stars and molecular biology, and they're correct. These are fascinating things. But, you know, this, what's happening here is unbelievably fascinating. But the second thing that is even more important is that we can get ourselves out of trouble. We could make less mistakes. We could live better lives. So, for example, one of the big projects I'm working on now is to try and think about the last chapter of people's lives. Think about the point from when people get a diagnosis of a terminal illness until people pass away. On average, this is slightly longer than 5 years, thanks to medical science. You know, mm-hmm. It's a long journey. And I am starting to ask the question of, what are the mistakes people make in this journey? And could we get people to make less mistakes? And the reality is that there are many mistakes. We can go into that, but I think that there is a possibility that the last chapter of people's lives will be one of their best chapters. I'm not talking about the last 3 weeks, but you know, last 5 years, if people get the right focus and they start fixing relationships and think about legacy and finding time to do things that they haven't found before, there's a lot of opportunities in this chapter. Of course, we don't do it right now. So if you think about where we are, human being, and where is our potential to live fulfilled life, that gap, I think a lot of it could be improved with a better understanding of social science, behavioral economics.
So one of my, I'm a pretty serious dilettante of psychology. Mostly because I was so screwed up. I worked really hard on improving myself. I won't say I fixed myself, because it's still a work in progress, but I got pretty in depth. And one of the frameworks that I have found a lot of value in helping people process their own life experience is the stages of psychosocial development theory by Eric Erickson. I actually am partly interested in how much you consider yourself a psychologist how that spills over into economics and where that line is. But like, are you familiar with the stages of psychosocial development?
Yeah, I am familiar, but I have to say that the kind of things I do are eventually much simpler, right?
Okay.
So I ask very simple questions like, how do we get people to eat better? And how do we get people to take our medications and exercise? And how do we get people to save money? And but really, really simple things. So there are lots of very interesting kind of big theories about life.
Right.
I'm more interested in the little details that make things better.
You like to study where the rubber meets the road, sounds like.
Yes, I think that's it.
So the reason I brought up the stages of psychosocial development is what Erickson teaches in that framework is that it mirrors what you said, that the last stage of life, what he calls late adulthood, is basically about resolving this. Every stage is framed in terms of a conflict. And that conflict that we're resolving in the last stage of our life, he calls ego integrity versus despair. And it's essentially, we're running out of time. And so we start to get obsessed with this question of, did I live in integrity with truly who I was, my ego in the Freudian sense? Mm-hmm. Or if not, because I'm running out of time, I lapse into despair. And so I'm sort of mirroring what you're saying, that like we all reach a point in our life where the fundamental question becomes basically, did I get it right? And to the extent that I have time left, or to the extent that I didn't, what can I do with the time I have left to try to change it? And we're all going to end up there. And what you're saying, I think, is that you're trying to give people little tools along the way so that they can have a lot more fun at the end of their life, not feeling like they have a big mess they need to fix.
That's right. So that's one project. It's not everything I do, but that's a good example of the kind of things that we're trying to do.
Okay. So the other thing I want to tease out from everything you've said, and that I feel like we'll have plenty of meat to chew on for the rest of our conversation here. When you were talking about the things that we do that are predictably irrational, one of the ones you said was the way we teach our kids. And you like immediately I just got excited because I basically, in this sense, I would say I'm not gonna call myself a behavioral economist because that would be an insult to actual behavioral economists. But I will say, I believe in part my career and my work at this point is a behavioral economics project to try to help solve for why we are teaching kids basic like basics about how to be fulfilled in life that are not actually true in the modern world. We're acting like the world is the same world it was 50 years ago when it clearly isn't, in the way we teach our kids. And then also I do remedial work to help adults who I would say have been essentially victims of that miscalibration to try to like adjust midlife on a track that more predictably leads to fulfillment. And that's, as an entrepreneur, you know, that my big thesis is that entrepreneurship, which is virtually, it's minimally talked about in schools, and certainly as like a skills foundation, I mean, the way schools are designed, I could not create a less entrepreneurial environment to raise kids in. And yet in the modern world, I have some data that says entrepreneurs are many, many times more likely to end up with the life that most people say it's what they want. And yet we're not teaching people how to do it. And then we have adults that are having midlife crises because they've worked the same dead-end job for 25 years and they're miserable and they're frustrated and they never see their kids. And I'm helping them adjust to it too. So maybe we could sort of like put the education question on the table here. Like, do you have any data or experiments or even just perspective on like, why are we teaching kids to operate in a world that no longer exists, and why haven't we done something about it?
Okay, so lots to say about this topic. So the first thing, of course, is what you said, is that the education system was designed a long time ago. And it was designed for a different world. It was designed for a world where learning to read and write and learning some math was the skills that people needed to get a desk job. We've way past that, but you know, the system is stuck. You know, one of the principles in behavioral economics is that change is very tough. But every time we want people to change, and it's very tough. And we call this default, the default option. right? So the classic example for this is organ donation. There are some countries where the organ donation form says, check the box below if you want to donate your organs. And almost nobody does. And there are other countries that says, check the box below if you don't want to donate your organs. And again, nobody checks the organ, but now they all donate. And you get a huge difference, but it's nothing to do with preferences. It's about what's easy. What's easy? If it's easier to donate, people donate. It's easy not to donate, people don't donate. In a much more mundane example in the US, when people go to a new job, they have a percentage they can put into retirement in the 401k. Depending on what the default is, that's what people donate. That's what people save for retirement. When you ask them later, why did you choose what you choose? Nobody said, oh, this was the default. But it was the default. So we follow what we call the path of least resistance. And the reality is that doing anything that is different from what we've done before is just very, very tough. So we end up doing the same thing over and over and over. And when we talk not about the person, but when we talk about the system, It's even tougher. By the way, I'm here with my laptop. You know, this keyboard arrangement, the QWERTY keyboard. You know the story about that, right?
But I'm sure there is one.
So it's called the QWERTY keyboard because that's the letters on the top left,
right?
QW and so on. This keyboard layout was invented in the days of the typewriter, and it was invented to slow down typing. It used to be that when people typed on a typewriter, these little hammers would bang into each other. So they created a keyboard layout that was designed to slow us down. Now, by now, we don't have these hammers. Nothing should slow us down. But think about how difficult it would be. There's a different system called Dvorak. There's a few other ones, but imagine how difficult it is to change, right? It's a system that makes, by design, everybody type slower than they would otherwise. And just think about how many hours, minutes, hours, days, years, millennia are lost.
Yeah.
Just because we have this system. So systems have a tendency to maintain themselves. Now with education, there's a couple of other sad things. One of them is the approach toward command and control. Mm-hmm. If you look at most districts and most states and most countries, it's not just in the US, there's a lot of notions of not giving people freedom, but instead controlling them. So there are tests, and the teachers have to teach exactly something specific, and you know, all of this is creating a command and control system. And then finally, I'll say something that is, you know, justifying a little bit. It's very hard to do experiments in education. Like, you know, when we have medications, the FDA forces us to experiment, right? You can't put a new medication on the market and not test it. When you put an education system out there, nobody asks you to test anything. But it's because it's very difficult. Imagine I came to you and I say, you know what? Would you give me your kids to be in a randomized control trial? They'll either get, a teacher per 15 students or a teacher for 30 students, and we'll see what's better. Very, very hard to do experiment. But the result is that we know very little about education. But even the things we know we need to do better, we don't necessarily do better.
Yeah, it's interesting. This is my my axe to grind, and we could go really, really deep on the education question. I will share this with you, and it's interesting because they don't even publish this data. I had to dig into it, but I'll share a data point with you that you might find interesting. So, you know, everybody, I'm saying this from the vantage point of people that come into my world filling out applications and telling me what they want with their life or what's missing from their life or why they're willing to take on an extra project to change their life. And the vast majority, it comes down to either I don't have enough money, I don't have enough time, or I don't like the fact that I have to use my time doing stuff I don't like to do to get money. Like, it's always time and money, right? And so I have this data that says, and I'll give you a little bit of the background on it, that there are basically about a little over 20 million millionaires in the United States. And 6 million of them are people that earned their $1 million plus net worth by having a job. And there are about 150 million employees in the United States. So if 6 million of them achieve $1 million net worth by having a job, then you have basically, you can say about 4% of all employees achieve millionaire status, right? Now there's 14 millionaires. There's like, I think 2 million that just inherited or have it, you know, they're outliers. But about 14 million millionaires are people that own businesses. And there's 31 million businesses in the United States. So statistically then, and by the way, like I forget, I think it's 5 million of those businesses, they've never generated a dollar of revenue. They just got a license and never did anything with it. So in practical terms, about half of all business owners achieve millionaire status, and only 1 out of 25 employees achieve millionaire status. So I'm always out there saying, statistically, it is so much higher probability to achieve your financial goals as an entrepreneur. Yeah. And yet you ask anybody, what's the safer path to achieve their goals? And they're all going to tell you, don't take the risk to start a business. And so anyway, I hold that up as an example of why education is completely missing the boat.
So you excuse my professor hat, but you did Please. Not take this, you did not take in this analysis the data about failure.
Right.
And it is true that you know, when people things don't go well, things can get very badly, not well if you
starting a business. Yeah.
If you took a loan, if you took this. By the way, that's a very general issue, is that the upside and the downside, we don't see them in equal terms. Right.
And that's a cognitive fallacy of humans, basically, right?
It's a little bit yes and it's a little bit no. So we call this loss aversion. Mm. And imagine I came to you with a bet, and I say, here's a coin. If you flip it and it comes on head, I'll give you $120. If it comes on tail, I'll take away from you 100. So plus 120, minus 100. The expected value is positive. You should play it, but most people don't play it. And they don't play it because they say, look, if I'll win $120, I'll be a little happy. But if I lose $100, I'll be really sad. Yeah. So let's not do it. And the evolutionary logic is that if you're in the jungle, like think about, you know, ancient time, you're an animal in the jungle. If something bad happened, you can get eaten and it's over. If something good happened, maybe you get to live another day or another 2 days. But there's a huge asymmetry among those things. But anyway, putting that aside, the realization is that when we come to look at risk, we usually look at risk one step at a time. Should I take this risk
or this risk?
So there is this story that Samuelson told, and the story is that he comes to his colleague and he give him the same bet I gave you, plus 120, minus 100, and his friend said, I'm not playing. And Samuelson said, what about if you played it 1,000 times? And the friend said, no, of course I want to play it. So Samuelson comes to him and he said, look, here's what you're telling me. You're telling me that if I came to you every day for 3 years, for 1,000 days, I came to you every day, and every day I said, would you like to take this bet? Every day you would say no. But if I say, would you like to take it 1,000 times? You would say absolutely yes. And this is the question of whether we look at each risk one at a time, or whether we look at life as a portfolio. And I think that one of the things we need to do is to stop thinking about each risk by itself. Because if we think about each risk by itself, and the downside of that risk, there'll be many risks we will not take. But if we think about how do we want to live our lives? Mm-hmm. I have 40 more years to live. How do I want to run it? What kind of risk level do I want to take? Yes, if I take risk, there's upside and there's downside. But what do I want to do as a portfolio? And under those things, under that line or mindset, I think people do take more risk when we think about it as a portfolio. And when you think as an entrepreneurship in an entrepreneurial way, one approach is to say, it's not all or none. Start small, have a side business. You know, it's not all or nothing. Test the water. You know, sorry for this. Do you know the research on being lucky?
No, talk to me, please.
Okay. So there's research that show that some people are luckier than others.
Like actually.
Well, now what does it mean to be lucky? Yeah, I'm very lucky, by the way. I'm very lucky. Now, what does it mean to be lucky?
Well, the saying is opportunity plus preparation equals luck.
Yes. So some of it is correct. So the first thing about luck is about just trying more things. Mm-hmm. Imagine two basketball players. One of them waits until they have 100% and they shoot twice in a game. The other one shoots when they have 50% chance and they shoot 40 times and they have 20 baskets. But life is mostly not just baskets. You know, baskets is binary. Yes, in or out, yes or no. Opportunities in life usually takes much longer to mature. So you start lots of things, you see what works and what doesn't work, you continue with the things that work and you stop wasting time on the things that don't work. And it ends up, this is what luck is about. Luck is about trying lots of things, even things that are far-fetched, but there's a portfolio. Seeing what works, what doesn't work, stop wasting time on the things that don't work and push the things that do work. And I'll give you two examples from my own life. So I'm a professor, I teach at the university, I do some research, write some books, but during COVID, I decided to try and write a kid's book. Don't know much about writing kid's book, but I decided to try it. And I decided to try and write a drama series for television, loosely based on my life. And, you know, both of them are low, odd events, but both of them end up working out. So I'm actually, in 10 days, I'm flying to Vancouver for the last day of filming of the TV show. It's on NBC and it's called The Irrational. And it's about the life of a professor who is also burned, has scars on the right side of their face and does research and helps the FBI. And the kids' book is going well. I found an illustrator and it's going well. You know, two things way out of my domain, but just trying out. Take this idea of taking risk and having a portfolio, I think are very important. And stop wasting time on things that don't work. These, I think, are the big keys.
Hey there, real quick, I just wanted to let you know, I have been concentrating a lot lately on providing tons of value to my text message community. This could be random thoughts, this could be letting you be the first to know about an event I'm planning or a special I'm running or a free training I'm hosting. Anyway, just shoot me a text to get subscribed. The number is 702-996-3926. Thanks so much. Let's get back to the podcast.
Yeah, I love this. You know, I'm always thinking, from each episode, it's kind of like, what's my core takeaway, right? You know, by the time I've done hundreds of these, it's not like I'll be lucky if I remember one thing from each episode. I'm feeling like this one, it could end up being this concept of a portfolio approach to life. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, you know, if you could just shift the odds slightly in your favor, then you can win simply by placing more bets.
That's right.
I really like that. So go ahead. Yeah, please.
Let me try and give you one more point. Let's see if you can remember two from this one. I'll come back to in a year and check. So I obviously have this strange look with this half a beard.
Which I was going to ask you about, especially since you brought up a TV show based on your life. But
So this half a beard has a couple of reasons. The first one is I was badly burned. Most of my body is covered with scars, including this side of my face. So there's just no hair. Yeah, on this side. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but of course, I could shave, half shave, and it would be less striking in this lack of symmetry. And for many years, I shaved. And when I shaved, I looked less strange. But then a few years ago, I went on a month-long hike, And during that month long hike, I didn't shave. Then I came out sort of like this. And I didn't like this look. The first time I looked in the mirror, I didn't like the look, and I was going to shave it. But I said, you know, I'll keep it for a few weeks, just for the fun and memory of the hike. And during those few weeks, to my surprise, I got a few messages from people who thanked me for the half a beard. Now, why did they thank me for the half a beard? These were people who were struggling with their own injuries. They were feeling that they were hiding something, you know, and they said the fact that I was like so much out there with my injury, so much saying I don't care, gave them a bit more courage to not hide their own injuries. I said, you know, if I help somebody else, maybe let me keep this half a beard. But the real strange thing happened about 4 months later, where 4 months later I felt that I was in a better place with my own injury. I felt I was looking at my scars not as more like a part of my own, the story of my life. You know, some people do tattoos. I have these scars. Yes, you know, my hands are not so good. I don't have much movement. I have lots of deformities and challenges. But I was more at peace with all of this. Like, it's okay, it's just part of me. And I thought to myself, why now? I'm 56. I got injured, over 35 years ago. Why why now? And here is what I think happened. Like, think about somebody like me that shaves. I wake up in the morning, this side is smooth, this side is stubble. I half shave. At the end of the day, it's more symmetrical. In fact, the process of shaving for me is also a process of hiding. It's also a process of becoming less non-symmetrical. I became less non-symmetrical after shaving than I was before shaving. And letting go of that and just accepting my, you know, bizarre look was actually very healing. Now, it's not always fun, kids point, people ask, you know, all kind of things happen. But it was very healing. It was very healing to basically kind of go through this exercise of self-acceptance. Now, what do I hope that you remember for this? That for me, the big topic about this is that here I am, a social scientist. I'm supposed to know these things, but I didn't. Mm. You know, I could predict how day number one would feel like with half a beard. Not so good. But I don't have any tools to predict month four. And for me, this is a bigger point about the fact that we are really bad in predicting the long-term consequences of different actions. How happy would I be if I did X? Very hard to tell. How miserable would I do? I can predict tomorrow. Very hard to predict the long term. And that also adds to the portfolio discussion, because it says that the risk we take, partially we need to take it because we're not good predictors of what will be good for us. If we accept that we're fallible, if we say, you know what, I'm not sure what job would work for me. I don't know what role I would be happy with. I don't know what, you know, all of those things. It basically said we just need to try, because if we don't try, we'll never know. And it's not enough. Like, we can't sit in our desk and reason our way through it. Some mm-hmm. things just need to try, and only with trying we would get a sense of what really works for us and doesn't work for us.
Yeah, that's man, there's so much gold here for, again, for my selfish purposes of inspiring people to be more open to entrepreneurship and what that makes possible for their life. I'm just going to have them come listen to this now. So I wonder if we could actually spend a little more time. When I was reading your bio and reading up more about you, it sounded like your accident or whatever. How, I don't know the full backstory. It sounded like there was maybe an explosion or something you were burned in, but that actually was a catalyst to your interest in, whether it was behavioral economics or just irrationality or whatnot. Is there a story there we're sharing?
Yeah. So I was badly burned, 70% of my body, almost 3 years in hospital, very, very tough injury. And hospital gave me lots of examples of things I didn't like. Mm. And the main one was the process of bandage removal. So imagine that most of your body is covered with burns. You have bandages, And every day, sometimes twice a day, somebody needs to take these bandages off. And it is terrible because when you get burned, there's no skin. So the bandages adhere to the flesh, right? There's like it bleeds and it gets stuck. Right. So taking it off is a real issue. And the question was, what is the best way to do it? To rip the bandages off quickly, short duration, but every moment is going to be very painful, or to take it off slower, more duration, much more duration, but the intensity is lower. And the thing about it was that the nurses really believed in the quick ripping approach, and I hated the quick ripping approach. But they did what they thought was right. So the first experiment I did when I left hospital and started studying with the university was an experiment about this topic. And what I found is that when you take an experience and you make it twice as long, you don't make it twice more miserable. But when you take an experience and you make the intensity higher, now you made it much more miserable. So the nurses were basically wrong. The nurses were wrong. And for me, this was a moment of revelation. I said, how can the nurses, kind, wonderful, passionate people who cared about me as their patient and all their patients and so on, how could they get it so wrong? How could they think that this is the right thing to do when in fact it was the wrong one? And then I realized that, you know, human intuition is just flawed. It's flawed in all kinds of ways. There's all kinds of things that we think are good for us, but in fact are not. And what we need to do is to study those things and help people figure out what actually works and doesn't work. And of course, there's lots. I don't recommend life in hospital to anybody, but when you live in a very intense environment, there are lots of things to observe, right? It's a place where lots of things come into focus. COVID was a period with lots of intensity, lots of things to observe. The war now between Israel and Gaza, incredible. So every time you get to a place with tremendous high intensity, there are things to observe that are, it's a bit like a microscope. All of a sudden, you focus on something and you see it, and then you can apply it to other places as well.
So, man, so much to so many options of places to go with that. Thanks for sharing your story. I'll sort of move us toward selfishly in the direction of my obsession, which is like human fulfillment. I really, really try, and I've resonated with so much of what you've said about thinking of life as a portfolio of decisions, thinking of life, you know, trying to assess risk in aggregate rather than just what's the next, you know, red light that I need to get through, so to speak. And, you know, ultimately, like the point, and it even gets to like our spirituality of like, we will have completely different assessments of risk if we think that all meaning and purpose is oriented within this finite time constraint of the time that we're here versus if we have some afterlife or so. I mean, like the big questions, right? And ultimately what I'm really, I mean, the reason I started a platform to teach people entrepreneurship isn't because I, you know, want the world to have more tax ID numbers. It's because I think from my own life experience that entrepreneurship affords people a higher probability of long-term fulfillment and reaching that last stage of life in ego integrity versus despair. Like that's why I do it.
Yeah. But so let me add something at this point. So I very much share your belief, and for me one of the key issues is autonomy and meaning, and. You know, you think about the things that people love doing. Actually, last year I went and did a clay pot. You know, my hands are terrible, but I did a clay pot like I did in fourth grade. I'm sure you have this. It used to be ashtrays, now it's a clay pot. And you know, I gave it to my mother, even though I was 55. But you know, it was delightful. It was like sitting there and making something, and the whole thing was me. The whole thing the whole thing was me. And it was my, not ideal, a little bit better than what I did in third grade, but it was my clay pot. And the reality is that in modern life, there are very few things that are ours. Like, you know, if you work at Apple, you make a tiny part of a phone, let's say. Mm-hmm. If you work, you do cars, you do whatever you do. Life is so complex and things are so big. And mostly we get further and further from having things that we can call our own. Also, companies don't do a good job at it, right? We don't write people's names on PowerPoint presentations, and the engineers of cars don't sign. I wish they all signed the bottom of the under hood and so on. We don't give people pride, and everybody's doing a small part, and the digital world is very tough. You know, there's something very fulfilling about the book, like a book that is yours from cover to cover.
Oh, yeah.
There's something, this is mine. There's something like that. And you know, there used to be a huge debate about open source software. And companies says, oh, if we do open source software, who would support it? And who? No.
Oh, yeah.
The people who write open source software are there day and night solving problems. It's their passion. It's their passion. And I think we all deserve that. I think the world is a little bit less, we don't have that many opportunities. Yes, we can cook. We can grow some tomatoes. But the opportunities to have something that is our own are just reducing.
Well, I'm going to pause it within the thing that I think that humans most deeply desire to have that sense of autonomy or call it ownership or dominion over, other than our own actual bodies. I think that's probably the number one. But I think the second one is our time. And that's the biggest thing I see in the modern world. And again, this is based on, you know, for me, I won't say that we've subjected it to full, you know, scientific and statistical rigor, but I have a very large body of data input from people coming in saying, this is my life and this is what I want to be different.
Yeah.
And that is the biggest thing that because fortunately we live in a world where bodily autonomy is still generally the norm, but time autonomy is not. I mean, time autonomy has been virtually destroyed in the modern world. Even when we have it, we end up giving it to a device where our attention has been hijacked and it's actually being, you know, monetized for other purposes. Like, we don't own our time anymore. So I just wanted to introduce that idea.
Yeah, that's right. There's also ideas, right? So, for example, when I think about the students who come to work with me, we brainstorm ideas, and it's always very important for them to take ownership of their ideas. By the way, here's an amazing study. Okay, imagine you take a young kid, 5 years old, and their parent is waiting for them outside of the room. And the kid is going with the research assistant into a room. And they do a painting together. And then the research assistant takes the painting, goes out of the room, shows the mother the painting and says, look what painting I did. So the research assistant takes credit for the painting. Now, there are two cases. In case number one, the kid is the one who is painting, but the research assistant gives them the instructions of what to paint. In the second case, the research assistant does the painting, but they paint the ideas of the kids. Here's the question. When is the kid, already at age 5, more upset when their labor was taken or when their idea was taken? Are they more upset when they did the hard work and the research assistant takes credit for it, or when they had the thought? It turns out the thought. Already at age 5, it's not about the labor. It's about the idea. We fall in love with our ideas. And what it means is we want to give people the ability to enjoy their own ideas, to feel that they have control, that we so I think a lot of it is not about execution. It's about ownership of the idea. It doesn't have to be a big idea. It doesn't have to be that, you know, you created SpaceX. Even if you do something small that works and it's your idea, then it's just so fulfilling.
Yeah. Like, you know. So if I could kind of vamp on what you just said, by the way, again, thank you. One more reason I'm going to just have people start listening to this if they're on the fence about entrepreneurship, because that story or that experiment or that study is so validating, or even dare I say vindicating for my worldview. But I think it's important to say, because one of the it's in my office over there, but I was just looking at an infographic our team drew up earlier. It's the reasons people don't start businesses. So there's 88 million people in America who say, I have thought very seriously about starting a business, like from a place of desire, but then I cut myself off from doing so because of these top three, you know, these top reasons. And I can't remember if it was the second or the, I think it was the second reason, the second most frequent reason. The first reason is they think they just don't have the money. They don't want the financial risk. But the second reason is I don't have an idea. I don't know what to do. I don't know what business to start. And so I think it's, you know, a lot of people, and again, I think this is a product of the school systems now, is that people are daunted by the idea of feeling pressure to have an original idea. Like a lot of people don't see themselves as ideators, you know, that they see themselves as doers or executors or, you know, task-oriented people that are waiting to be told what to do. And that's the biggest mindset challenge we deal with in helping employees transition to entrepreneurship, is that initiative, right? But a lot of it is insecurity around not trusting or not conceiving of ourselves as people who have ideas. So I think what's really important to understand is that, like you said, ideas don't have to be big and you know, globally disruptive, because every idea is unique within its own context. So an example I'll give is, like, you might have an idea of how to satisfy a customer's hunger with this new penny pasta dish you created at your restaurant. That's not some grand, unique idea. But in the sense of that particular customer who's hungry at that moment and the satisfaction they're going to get as a product of your idea to cook them up something off menu, you can get that same type of satisfaction as maybe if you cured cancer or whatever. And so I think people put too much pressure on themselves about what an idea actually means.
So I do think it will not compete with curing cancer, but you are correct. And there's another pointer that the idea doesn't have to be there in the beginning. You know, if science is teaching us something, is that we learn while doing. Like, you know, I'm frankly not smart enough to just sit and envision the full consequence of a set of studies. But I could do study one and I can get the result, and I could do study two and I can continue with that. And the reality is that, you know, we do many experiments that surprise us. And every experiment that surprises means we didn't predict it, right? But we learned something. And I think it's a journey. So, you know, do I want people to say, let me sit at my desk and think about the idea until it's ready? I would say no. Think about step one, simple proof of concept. What do you want to do? Prove to yourself that this is correct. Move to the next one, and then take it from there. Let's just take a simple example. Let's just say that, you know, one of the things that is very sad is that money is one of the things that people fight a lot about. Mm-hmm. You look at divorces, lots of people fight over money. Just a shame, right? Why do we fight so much over money? Imagine you said, you know what? It's a problem. I'm recognizing the problem in the world. People fight too much about money, and I want to reduce it. Now, do you have the solution? No, but you can start thinking, and you can say, okay, so how would I design differently a bank account? How would I design differently a joint bank account that would get people to fight less? And how would I design a credit card? Would I give people one credit card or two credit cards, separate or the same version? Would I turn on notification or off? And you can say, let me go and talk to people. Let me see. Are people who have two credit cards happier or less happy? Some things you could find out, some things you know, but you can build it up. You don't have to have all the answers up front. And it's true for everything. Like, it's not, I think that sometimes we wait and wait and wait for an idea rather than saying the problem that excites us and let's do it. And when I did a couple of startups, but mostly I do research. But when I do research, you know, when, like yesterday, the day before yesterday, I had a chat with a new student. He's an undergrad thinking about what he wants to do. And he gave me a whole list about his classes, what classes he's taken, which one he liked more and less. And I asked him, what are your hobbies? And I said, I want to know what are the kind of things that interest you that would sustain your interest. Research is sometimes boring. You need to have energy from somewhere else. What are your hobbies? Tell me about what excites you, and maybe we can find out something within that. So it turns out he's a big sports fan, and we'll see if we can find something that would do that, right? But it's really about engaging our passion. Yes, you know, I do hope that everybody would make more money and have a successful company and so on. But even if you don't, let's say you have two paths of life and you make the same amount of money, but in one of them you engage your passion. That's obviously much, much better. So I think we all need to look inside and ask ourselves, what questions are we passionate about? Are we passionate about education? Are we passionate about health? Are we passionate about reducing hate, misinformation, whatever it is? And then we should say, start from there.
Well, and so I've two thoughts. The first is, I think, you know, in terms of people not starting because they don't have the idea, and you're saying, well, you don't even have to have the idea. Just think about a problem that you'd like to solve. I would suggest that a lot of times you don't even have to have a problem you want to solve, because all problems exist in the context of other established ideas. Every problem at some level is a flaw in an idea. So I'll use my career or my history as a jazz musician. I majored in music composition, and I was a professional jazz piano player for a while. And so a lot of traditional, like more classically trained musicians are very intrigued by the idea of improvisation. Like, how do you make music up on the spot? And because as classical musicians, they're so, you know, oriented toward not playing wrong notes. Yeah. We live on wrong notes. That's all we play, right? And but what I think about is that, like, everything I've learned about improvisation, and a lot of great jazz musicians will say the number one guy to learn from is Bach, is actually learning how to create lines by playing Bach. So you're basically trying to install as many of Bach's ideas into your core as possible to define this set of possibilities that you can start to be inventive with then, and then eventually you find your own voice in your own way. And I think there's so much truth in that. Like, in business, you don't have to start with a unique idea. You don't even have to know what problem you're trying to solve. Just do a business that is a copy of someone else's business, and inevitably in the process, you'll bump up against something. You'll go, wait, I bet there's a better way to do that. And that little moment could end up becoming your entire obsession. It could end up becoming an entirely new business that just solves that problem for everybody else that has the same kind of business. And so, yeah, I'm totally with you around, I think the way it all goes back to what you said about the way we process risk. Mm-hmm. It's like, if we don't, and there's a saying in entrepreneurial circles that a lot of people don't want to leave the house unless somebody tells them that, oh, don't worry, all the lights are already green. Well, then if you do that, you never leave the house, right? And so anyway, I just wanted to share that. I wonder, I know you just wrote a book. I want to make sure you have proper platform to you know, evangelize yourself here. I know you just wrote a book. Like, what would you like to make sure the audience knows about you and how they can come find you?
So I have a website, www.danariely.com, danariely.com. So I wrote a few books. The last book actually was thrusted on me. Some COVID deniers decided that I was responsible for COVID. And as a consequence, I got terrible death threats. Even last month, my university got a letter that they had to sent to the authorities. But I also started studying this topic. You know, we all have people in our lives that a while ago we thought were similar to us, and now we said, you know, I don't see eye to eye. I don't understand how we ever saw eye to eye. So this book is really about the psychology of people changing their opinions and dissenting into misbelief.
Yeah.
Coming on election season, I think it's very important for us to understand how people get their opinions, how they change their opinions, how do we maintain civility and, you know, don't become two different countries. So I think it's an important book. And I think with the time now in our lives, it's very important. The separation, the lack of trust, you know, identity politics, just important to understand the world that we live in. So that's the plug.
Awesome. Yeah, misbelief. I see the subtitle here. What makes rational people believe irrational things?
Yep.
I'd love to read it. All right, Dan. Hey, I want to respect your time. Selfishly, I hope I can talk to you again sometime because you've created as many questions as answers here. But this has been great, man. Thank you for being a guest on Unlock Your Potential.
With pleasure. Thank you so much.
Of course. And to all you viewers and listeners out there, you are the best part of this show. Why we do it every time. I can't wait to see you again on the next one. Take care.
Hey, it's Jeff here. If you liked this episode of Unlock Your Potential, it would mean so much if you would like and share the episode on whatever platform you're listening or viewing on. And if you really like what we're doing here and you enjoy this podcast, please consider leaving a review. There is so much work that goes into these episodes, and you leaving a positive review lets us know that that work is reaching people, and especially it helps us reach other people. Your review could be the reason that someone else decides to tune in, check out this podcast, and unlock their potential and ultimately level up the quality of their life. So thank you so much for your support and for listening, especially if you like or share or leave a review. Thank you for helping us spread the word, and thank you for unlocking your potential to go make the world and your world a better place.